Well, good afternoon, and welcome to the Mike Wilson Show on WWGH. Excuse me. And on the phone, I have Fred Malone. Fred?
Good evening.
Good evening. Good talk to you.
Yeah, good talk to you.
Shut this phone off here, so that's better. Much better. So, Fred, I guess we're going to start off talking about one-room schools tonight, aren't we?
Yeah, last time I was on, we talked about the early schools in Marion County, and we ran out of time before I got to a little more specific information about one-room schoolhouses. Of course, we had a number of those in Marion County back in the day. I think I've heard as many as few as 30 and as many as 40 one-room schools in the county. And, of course, the big reason for that is kids had to get to school on their own. They didn't have school buses and transportation like we do today. So the schools needed to be placed within no more than a couple of miles centrally located among farms. So there were a number of them around in those days. But what I wanted to concentrate more on for the first few minutes tonight is to finish up that subject again, talking about one-room schools, and I wanted to concentrate a little bit about our one-room school that the Marion County Historical Society owns and maintains, the Lynn School. And then at on or about 5:30, I'm going to switch over to our main subject tonight, and that's going to be talking about the SS Eastland, which I'm sure hardly anybody knows about, but they'll learn tonight.
Yes, I'm curious because I'm not quite sure what that is myself.
You'll find out. So a little bit more about the early schools in the county, or this actually was the way one-room schoolhouses were throughout pretty much throughout the entire country. But in the early schools, of course, each child owned their own slate to write on. They used that, of course, for practicing their script, and it went back and forth with the student each day when they went to school. Now, the student scratched on that slate with what was called a slate pencil, obviously a piece of slate, fashioned to look like a pencil with a little point on it. Eventually, that slate pencil was replaced by soft chalk, and that made it a little bit easier to write. And, of course, the teacher could use the chalkboard, and they could see what was going on that way, too. Students didn't preserve their work, so memorization was expected, and they did that through recitation. And in most of the one-room schoolhouses, including Lynn School, we have what's called a recitation bench. And that's set at the front of the school where kids would go up and sit down and the teacher would quiz them on their lessons and they would recite what they'd learned. A keen memory characterized a good student. So if you were exceptionally good, you obviously had a very good memory. Now, after the Civil War, the lead pencils came along, and those are kind of similar to what was used today. And this meant that their work was now, or could now, be written on paper, and it made the work more portable for both the teacher and the students. And, of course, most students owned a pencil box. I know I had a pencil box when I was a kid in elementary school. Mm-hmm. And that was, of course, to transport their pencils back and forth to school so they wouldn't get lost. The pencil was a substantial improvement, obviously, from the early slate pencils and even the chalk and even the quill pen that was used even prior to that. Its narrow design made it easier for kids to control their writing, and they could develop their lettering and their numbering skills and again, use paper to keep those things with them all the time. Now, early 19th century schools and students typically played games, and they socialized outside the school in the mornings before the classes started. And unless the school had a bell tower, and we at Lynn School do have a bell tower, the teacher would stand at the door and ring a handbell. And that was their signal that the kids knew it was time to come in the morning, or if they were out playing during a recess or at lunchtime, when they heard the bell, they needed to come in. So students needed to be within earshot to hear that bell. Otherwise, they might risk punishment for being tardy.
Yes.
Which they didn't want to do because punishments were considerably more severe then. We'll talk about that later. The Bible was a very important part of the early one-room schoolhouses. Religious and moral education of the youth was very, very important. The first book in the classroom was the Bible. It was central to a child's education, not only for its content, but the way it was used to build skills. Now, of course, we know today that the separation of church and state, religion is not talked about in the school, so a vast difference from what it was in the 1800s and even into the early 1900s. Students learn how to read using the Bible, And much of the school day was actually devoted to memorizing and reciting passages from the Bible. And those passages were also copied then onto their paper, and that was, of course, to help learn their penmanship. Now, the actual first textbook that was used was called the New England Primer, and that was used between 1760 and 1843. And, of course, the most popular school book in the 19th century was, of course, the McGuffey Reader, mm-hmm. which we all know about. That was introduced in the mid-1830s. Based on landmarks of world literature, there was a set of six readers, which increased in difficulty as the older you got, and that was the basis for teaching literacy, as well as basic values such as honesty and charity and other things like that. The readers gave the teacher flexibility she lacked before, allowing her to more easily teach a classroom of pupils of different ages and levels, because remember, in one-room schoolhouses, she might have kindergarten-age kids in the very front and eighth graders clear in the very back of the school. So she was busy teaching all different levels at all different times. Obviously, 10 millions of copies of this book were sold during the 19th century. And in rural America, the McGuffey Reader was often the only exposure people had to any kind of world literature. And if you're very much of an antique person or like to go to antique malls or flea markets, you can pick up McGuffey Readers almost anywhere. They're just all over the place. Discipline, we talked a little bit there earlier. There was more severe discipline back in the day. Throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, wooden canes were used to enforce discipline in the classroom. A little later on in the 1850s, they introduced the leather strap, and along with the hickory switch, which is a narrow branch of green wood garnished from a tree outside the school building, and it was often cut by the student that was in trouble.
Yes, I've
heard. And, of course, they got spankings in those days. They got whipped a little bit. In the early schools, children often sat on three-legged stools or long benches behind narrow tables. These were often made of pine or oak or whatever the parents of the school children would fashion. And then by the 1880s, children sat at individual desks, which is what we have out at Lynn School, and those are bolted to the floor. And interestingly enough, when the kids would come in the morning, the boys sat on the right side of the room and the girls sat on the left side of the room.
Oh.
And the reason for that was when Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden and Eve handed the apple to Adam, she handed it to him with her left hand. So the girls were then made to sit on the left side of the room because of that.
Oh, okay.
Strange custom. Younger children sat at the front of the room, as I said earlier, closest to the teacher. And this arrangement, of course, then enhanced the teacher's learning environment. So that was very popular throughout that time. And again, they were teaching different ages of students. Students rarely faced each other, and all their attention then was focused directly to the teacher in the front of the room. Heating, very important part of school life. Most one-room schoolhouses, including Lynn School, had a potbelly stove.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the benefit of this kind of a stove was that it burned lots of different kinds of fuel. You could burn wood, you could burn coal, corn cobs, bound-up straw, and you could even burn cow chips, which, by the way, burn very well. I don't know how much you know about cow chips.
I've stepped on a few, but yeah.
And it's a hot heat, too.
Okay.
Farmers, of course, usually provided fuel for the stove. Sometimes parents would help. But it was the teacher's responsibility to maintain that fire. Now, if a teacher was fortunate enough to live nearby, she didn't have to get up quite so early to get there in the morning to stoke the fire. If she lived at the school building, which some teachers did in one-room schools, they had a curtain that they could pull across the classroom portion, and she lived in the front part of the building.
Oh.
And she was already there and kept the fire going mostly for her own satisfaction. But if she lived a long way off, that meant getting to school early in the morning to stoke the fire. Students that sat close to the fire were, of course, too warm and usually had a hard time staying focused on what they were doing because they would nod off because
sure.
of the heat. But then on the other hand, students who had to sit in the corner or by the drafty windows often got cold and had to wear lots of layers of clothing and maybe even a hat in order to keep themselves warm enough to pay attention to what the teacher was talking about. Homework, very important part, obviously, of today's life. But even so, it was very important back in the days of the one-room school. Any books that were brought to and from the school were generally bound together with a leather strap and carried on their hip. They didn't have backpacks, you know, like the kids have today to distribute that weight. But then on the other hand, they generally would only have one or two books that they were going to be carrying out of the building. Most of the books stayed in the schoolroom and were left there for fear that they would become lost or destroyed. And since that was the only source of books that they had, they were oftentimes made to keep them there. Children were very, in the early American schools, usually didn't have a whole lot of homework, again, because of the situation with the books, but also because we have to bear in mind that most of them, coming from farm backgrounds, had responsibilities on the farm.
Sure.
Or even if they were, so to speak, village or city kids, they still had responsibilities at home, unlike a lot of kids today. And with that thought, and with that said, it's important to remember that in the days of the one-room schoolhouse, like Lynn School, schools didn't start until after all the crops were taken in the fall and all the work was done on the farm. So they may not even start school until late October, early November. And generally, school would only run until the early spring when planting and all the chores on the farm had to be started, and then they were depending on the kids to put in a full day there. So it was a very short school year, unlike what it is today with, roughly 6 months or 8 months or whatever
right.
it is. 9 months, I guess. Of course, we don't know what it's going to be now with this pandemic going on. But anyway, all their academic learning took place during that school day only. So generally, there wasn't much homework. Consequently, unless the family could afford books on their own, the only reading a student did was at school with what was available there. Penmanship, very important skill, and it was commonly believed that the appearance of one's script or writing was more important than its accuracy. And if you've ever seen a script from those days, very beautiful penmanship. Of course, nowadays, they've pretty much done away with penmanship with the cursive being gone. I think maybe some of the schools are starting to do it again, but not like they did back then. If they were using quill pens, it was the teacher's job to whittle those goose quills and make them ready for the ink wells. If you happen to live in a city, ink that you were using was made of an ink powder mixed with water. In the country, sometimes it was made with lamp black or tannic acid from oak trees mixed with a light oil, or even sometimes what they called swamp maple bark that would be found out in the swamp areas. So a lot of the stuff had to be made on their own. Writing with ink obviously could be very messy, so students used blotting paper or blotting pads to absorb the excess ink from the page when they were finished. Particularly more difficult for kids that were left-handed, because as you write, obviously, you're going to be rubbing your hand over that ink. And that was one of the reasons why the teachers in the early days tried to prevent a kid from being left-handed. Even if they came in left-handed, most generally before the school year was over or for a couple of years, wherever, they had them converted to write with their right hand. School lunches were provided by kids bringing their lunch to school. They were too far away from home to go home at lunch, most generally. So they brought their own lunches in a sturdy metal bucket or a pail. And they might have such things as bread and jam or meat sandwiches. They might have hard-boiled eggs and dill pickles. They might even bring a potato to sit on the stove and bake during the day while they were waiting for lunch. In the middle of the day, school would stop for a lunch break, and they would have time to eat and visit with their friends and maybe even have a little recess time. Tests and quiz were very, very common in the early schools. Teachers would, of course, measure your knowledge by conducting an oral stand-up quiz at the end of each school day, or use the recitation bench to have you come up and recite your multiplication tables or whatever the day's lesson might be. And standardized tests of any major significance were not introduced until the 1870s. And in order to then attend a high school, if you were going to go beyond the eighth grade, students from the rural schools then were required to pass the eighth grade examination administered test in the county seat. And that was the way they were able to then go on to high school. So that's a little bit about early one-room schoolhouses and Lynn School. Lynn School, by the way, is not going to be open this season. Obviously, we have the damage last year, which created some issues for us.
Yes.
Which most people know. And with the COVID and everything else that's been going on, it was just decided that we would wait and not open the school until next year. So that's pretty much what I wanted to conclude with as far as the one-room schoolhouse is concerned.
Well, let me bring up one thing about the Lynn School. They had a unique feature in their front yard.
I'm getting a drink of water. Go ahead.
Okay. A unique feature in their front yard that ran right through there?
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
Not sure I'm connecting.
A train?
Oh, yes. The Interurban. Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely. The Interurban ran right down the middle of the road there. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So later on, that of course didn't occur until sometime in the 20s and 30s, so those kids could hop on the Interurban.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Well, today we're going to talk about the SS Eastland and its disaster. I'm going to lead off with the headline from the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 24th, 1915. This is my teaser. Over 2,000 Western Electric employees and their families, dressed in their finest, arrived early at the riverfront to board the Eastland, a bold and breathtaking steamship. The boat is scheduled to ferry its passengers to the annual company picnic in Michigan City. Suddenly, as it sits in port, the Eastland begins to list. While thousands of people watch in horror, the ship rolls to its side and silently capsizes at the dock.
Oh, my.
Have you heard of the Eastland?
I have not.
A little background, and then we'll talk about the sinking. The ship was originally commissioned during 1902 by the Michigan Steamship Company and was built by the Jenks Shipbuilding Company out of Port Huron, Michigan. The ship was named during May of 1903, immediately before its inaugural voyage. On July 27th, for 1903 inaugural season, the ship struck the laid-up tugboat George W. Gardner and sank the tugboat at her dock at the Lake Street Bridge in Chicago, but received only minor damage itself. Now, is this a foretelling of the incoming doom?
Sure sounds like it, doesn't it?
On August the 14th of 1903, while on a cruise from Chicago to South Haven, Michigan, six of the ship's firemen refused to stoke the fire for the ship's boiler. They claimed that they had not received their potatoes for a whole meal.
Oh.
When they refused to return to the fire hole, Captain John Peru ordered the six men arrested at gunpoint. Fireman George Lippin and Benjamin Myers, who were not a part of the group of six, stoked the fires until the ship reached harbor. Upon the ship's arrival in South Haven, the six men, Glenn Watson, Mike Devron, Frank Lapart, Edward Fleming, Mike Smith, and William Madden, were taken to the town jail and charged with mutiny. Shortly thereafter, Captain Perdue was replaced. It continues. Because the ship did not meet a targeted speed of 22 miles per hour during its inaugural season and had a draft that was too deep for the Black River in South Haven, Michigan, where it was being loaded, the ship returned in September of 1903 to Port Huron for modifications, including the addition of an air conditioning system and machinery adjustments to reduce the draft. Now, I'm not quite sure how that affected the draft, but obviously they thought with those modifications it would. Even though the modifications increased the ship's speed, they added additional weight, which obviously it would, and reduced her draft, thereby reducing the metrocentric height and inherent stability as originally designed. So we're not creeping along a very good path. Upon her return to South Haven in May of 1904, the ship handily won a race against the city of South Haven to Chicago. Now, in the meantime, the Eastland was experiencing a lot of problems with her stability. While loading and unloading cargo and passengers and nearly capsized on July 17th of 1904, after it left South Haven with approximately 3,000 passengers. Subsequently, her capacity was lowered to 2,800 passengers.
Hmm.
Now, cabins were removed. lifeboats were added, and the hull was repaired. Then on August the 5th of 1906, another incident of listing occurred, which resulted in the filing of complaints against the Chicago South Haven Line. Now, that's the company that had purchased the ship earlier that year. Before the 1907 season, the ship was sold to Lakeshore Navigation Company and moved to Lake Erie. In 1909, the ship was sold again to the Eastland Navigation Company, and it continued running excursions between Cleveland and Cedar Point. Now, of course, Cedar Point was a very popular destination for people that lived anywhere along the Great Lakes. And, of course, it's still a very popular destination today for anybody that live in, the tri-state area at the very least.
Yes.
Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, and probably even New York. So even then they were running excursions back and forth from Cleveland. Now, after the 1909 season, there were 39 cabins still on board, but those were removed. And then prior to the 1912 season, the top smokestack sections were removed to shorten her stack height. Now, I'm not quite sure whether or not they thought this was going to help the stability or not. I would assume, given the fact that if you've ever seen any of those early ocean-going liners, or in this case, Lake Erie-going liners or Great Lakes liners, they did have very tall steamships on them. You remember seeing the movie The Titanic?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that had, I believe, four stacks on it.
Mm-hmm.
The two in the middle were extremely tall. I forget the height on them, but several hundred feet high. So I'm assuming that they thought by taking out the top smokestack, that would, of course, help that stability issue that they'd had earlier on, and which was going to be a problem down the road, which they didn't know at that time. On July the 1st of 1912, another incident occurred when the Eastland had a severe listing of approximately 25 degrees while loading passengers in Cleveland. Now, 25 degrees, that's a pretty good list.
Yes, it is.
You're going to have probably a hard time almost even standing up with that much of a list. In June of 1914, the Eastland was then sold again to the St. Joseph Chicago Steamship Company, and it returned to Lake Michigan for St. Joseph, Michigan to Chicago, Illinois service. So they were going to run people from St. Joseph down to Chicago across Lake Michigan. Maybe they thought if they tried a different lake, that might help. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Although they were on Lake Michigan before, to somewhat. Now let's talk a little bit about what happened on that fateful day that we gave that headline for. The SS Eastland, at that time, was a passenger ship that was based in Chicago, and it was basically, at that time, it was basically being used for tours. On July 24th of 1915, the Eastland and four other Great Lake passenger steamers, the Theodore Roosevelt, the Petroski, the Racine, and the Rochester, had been chartered by the Western Electric Company to take employees from Western Electric Company's Hawthorne Works, that was located in Cicero, Illinois, to a picnic in Michigan City, Indiana, which, of course, would have been across the lake. This was a major event in the lives of these workers. Now, as you can imagine, most of those workers that were working for Western Electric back in 1915 were below middle class.
Okay.
And I don't want to say this in a bad way, but obviously they were, most of them were immigrants that were living in Chicago and working in the city's factories in some shape or form. Most of these people were either uneducated or ill-educated. Most of them were most generally first-generation citizens in this country, probably having come from Ellis Island and then migrating west to some of the bigger cities to find work. Obviously, New York filled up quickly with the immigrants that came in. So, you know, their background was of a very simple life. Most of them lived in the tenement buildings in Chicago, Lower East Side, portions of the area that were definitely not prosperous. They were generally living on one income. Most of the time, the father might have been the only one that worked and generated an income, unless mom or some of the older children happened to work in maybe the garment district or areas where the kids were being used for as child labor. So they weren't garnishing very large paychecks from that respect. So an event that was taking place like this once a year, where they had the opportunity to go and relax and have a good time and play and ride the rides at a popular amusement park, or just have a picnic away from the dirt and the grime and the dust, the noise of the inner city of Chicago, that was a really big deal. So you can understand what they were thinking when they were boarding the Eastland that morning, most of them in their finery. They probably only had one good set of clothes, maybe what they would wear to church on Sunday, or if they were going to a party or some kind of a big event, which this would, of course, be considered for them. This was truly an exceptional day in their lives. So just to set the scene, remember that these people are hardworking. They're mostly immigrants. A lot of them didn't speak English. In fact, the majority of them didn't speak English. So it was difficult even to communicate other than to the little groups that they were, you know, associating with themselves. So this was definitely a major, major, major event in the lives of these workers. And they just didn't take holidays, you know. They were fortunate if they got Sundays off. Most of them worked 6 days a week, and there weren't such things as we take today, you know, like Labor Day, Memorial Day, and President's Day, and all the things that we take for granted. Many of the passengers that were loading up on the Eastland that day were Czech immigrants directly from Cicero. And of these Czech passengers, 220 of the number that perished, and I haven't given the total number yet, but 220 of the number of passengers that perished that day were Czechoslovakian immigrants alone. That's a pretty substantial number.
Yes, it is.
During 1915, the new Federal Seamen's Act had been passed because, and everybody will know this, of the RMS Titanic disaster that had occurred just 3 years earlier.
Right.
In 1912. And, of course, you know, the Titanic got a lot of publicity, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of these other disasters that occurred, maritime disasters, don't get the recognition that they should get because everything went focused on the Titanic. But anyway, the Seamen's Act that had recently been passed was a law that required retrofitting of a complete set of lifeboats on all these passenger vessels, and on the Eastland in particular, again, as on many other passenger vessels in addition. This additional weight could possibly have made the Eastland more dangerous by making it even more top-heavy, even though they had done the work with the ballast and they'd done the work taking the stacks off. When they passed a law that required the additional... dog's barking.
I hear that.
When they required the additional lifeboats, this added, obviously, a lot more weight to the ship itself. So, who knows? I mean, that could have, that may have made a difference, may not have. Some argued that other Great Lakes ships would also suffer from the same problem. Nonetheless, the law was signed in by President Woodrow Wilson, and the Eastland was already so top-heavy that it had special restrictions concerning the number of passengers that could be carried. Now, prior to that, during June of 1914, Eastland had again changed its ownership. This is, what, about the sixth time, I think, the ownership had changed. Again, bought by the St. Joseph and Chicago Steamships Company that we mentioned earlier, with a Captain Henry Peterson appointed as the ship's master. Now, on the morning of July the 24th, passengers began boarding Eastland on the south bank of the Chicago River between Clark and LaSalle Streets at around 6:30 in the morning, and by 7:10, the ship had reached its capacity of 2,572 passengers. 2,572 passengers.
Wow.
The ship was packed,
mm-hmm.
with many passengers standing on the open upper decks, and it started to list slightly to the port side. That would be away from the wharf.
Okay.
To the dock. The crew attempted to stabilize the ship by admitting water to its ballast tanks, but that didn't help. Sometime during the next 15 minutes, a number of the passengers rushed to the port side, and at 7:28 a.m., the Eastland lurched sharply to the port and rolled completely over onto its port side, coming to rest on the river bottom.
Mm.
Now, that was only about 20 feet below the surface. Barely half the vessel was submerged. However, that's where most of the passengers were. Many other passengers had already moved below the decks on this relatively cool and damp morning to warm up before the departure. Consequently, hundreds of people were trapped inside and by the sudden rollover. Some of these people were crushed by heavy furniture, including pianos that were on board, bookcases and tables, and other human beings. Although the ship was only 20 feet from the wharf, and in spite of the quick response by the crew of a nearby vessel, the Kenosha, which came alongside the hull to allow those stranded on the capsized vessel to leap for safety, a total of 844 passengers and four crew members died that morning.
Wow.
844 passengers died, and they were 20 feet from the dock.
Oh.
Unbelievable. The bodies of the victims were taken to various temporary morgues established in the area for identification. And by the afternoon, the remaining unidentified bodies were consolidated in the armory of the 2nd Regiment on the site which was later transformed into Harpo Studios. We all know who owns Harpo Studios.
Yes, yes. That's her name spelled backwards.
She used to have a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Reporter on
Oprah,
TV.
Yes.
You remember the name?
Oprah Winfrey, yes.
Oprah Winfrey, right.
Mm-hmm.
But that has been since demolished for a McDonald's headquarters now is on that site.
Okay.
But that's where the armory was that stood where they took the bodies.
Okay.
In the aftermath, the Western Electric Company provided $100,000 to relief and recovery efforts of family members of the victims of the disaster. It was a long time before they were able to get all the people out. One of the people who were scheduled to be on the Eastland that day was 20-year-old George Hallis, an American football player. You've heard of George Hallis?
I have not.
Who was delayed leaving for the dock and arrived after the ship had overturned. His name had been listed on the list of deceased in the newspapers, but when his fraternity brothers visited his home to send their condolences, he was revealed to be unharmed. He didn't make it. Hallis would go on then to become coach and owner of the Chicago Bears and a founding member of the National Football League. His friend and future Bears executive, Ralph Brizola, and his brothers were on board the Eastland when it capsized, though they escaped, fortunately for them, through portholes. Despite stories to the contrary, there are no reliable evidence indicated that Jack Benny was aboard, although there were some rumors to that effect at one time, or scheduled to be on the excursion. Possibly the basis for this report was that the Eastland was a training vessel during World War I, and Jack Benny apparently had received his training in the Great Lakes Naval Base where the Eastland had been stationed.
Oh, okay.
The first known film footage taken of the recovery efforts was recently discovered and then released during 2015 by a graduate student at the University of Illinois in Chicago. A person by the name of Marion Eichholz was the last known survivor of the capsizing, and that individual died November the 24th, 2014, at the age of 102. Now, interestingly enough, not many people have heard of this particular ship. And I ran across it quite by accident a number of years ago when I happened to be in a bookstore and just browsing through books saw this one titled The Sinking of the Eastland, America's Forgotten Tragedy. And I picked it up and started browsing through it and realized that this was something that I knew nothing about. And because of my knowledge and interest in the sinking of the Sultana, the riverboat that sank during the end of the Civil War, bringing soldiers back from the southern prison camps up to the Midwest, I thought, this is a book I got to read, and I got to find out all about the Eastland, which I knew nothing of. So if anyone out there is interested in getting more information on this and finding out some of the interesting stories about the rescues that were made and some of the other things that took place that day, they can do so by, you know, probably going to Amazon or Google Books and just looking up the sinking of the Eastland, and I'm sure they'll get some information on it. It's a wonderful book. It was published back in 2004. It's not a very hard read. I think it's only 200-300 pages long, but well worth the time and effort. A little bit about the Eastland disaster and the media, since we got a little bit of time here. Writer Jack Woodford witnessed this disaster and gave a first-hand account to the Herald and the Examiner, both Chicago newspapers. And in his autobiography, Woodford writes this, and I quote, "And then movement caught my eye. I looked across the river. As I watched in disoriented stupefaction, a steamer as large as an ocean liner slowly turned over on its side as though it were going away, being a whale taking a nap. I didn't believe a huge steamer had done this before my eyes. Lashed to a dock in perfectly calm water, in excellent water, with no explosion, no fire, nothing. I thought I'd gone crazy." Can you imagine seeing that?
Oh, no.
Watching that. Just turn over, upside, going from right up to upside down, right in front of your face. Obviously, newspapers played a significant part in not only publicizing the Eastland disaster, but of course also creating the public memory of the catastrophe. But how short-lived are we, you know? Unless you happen to stumble across this like I did, you would never know. The newspaper's purposes, audience, and political and business association influenced the newspapers to publish articles emphasizing who was to blame and why it had capsized. Consequently, the articles influenced how the court cases proceeded and contributed to a dispute between the Western Electric Company and some of its workers regarding how the company responded to the catastrophe. Carl Sandburg, I think just about everybody knows Carl Sandburg. He was then known better as a journalist than a poet, but he later wrote a lot of poetry and also wrote some books about Lincoln. Wrote an angry account accusing regulators of ignoring safety issues and claimed that many of the workers were there on company orders for a staged picnic. So there's kind of a difference in an agreement on whether this is voluntary or not. Sandburg also wrote a poem called The Eastland that contrasts the disaster with the mistreatment and poor health of the lower class at the time, and we talked about that earlier. After first listing the quick, murderous horrors of the disaster, then surveying the slow, murderous horrors of extreme poverty, Sandburg concludes by comparing the two. He says, and I quote, "I see a dozen Eastlands every morning on my way to work, and a dozen more going home at night." The poem was too harsh for publication when it was written, but was eventually released as part of a collection of his poems during the early 90s. The Eastland disaster was incorporated into the 1999 series premiere of the Disney Channel called So Weird, and I don't remember that series at all.
I don't either.
Of course, I didn't have Disney. I didn't even know there was a Disney Channel back then, but I don't remember that series at all. And it goes on to say that in one episode, the teenage paranormal enthusiast Fiona Phillips, played by an actress, encounters the ghost of a young boy who drowned during the capsizing while exploring a nightclub near the Chicago River and attempts to learn why he has contacted her. And then during 2012, Chicago's Looking Glass Theater produced an original musical about the disaster entitled Eastland. And a new musical written by Andy White, the Eastland disaster is also pivotal to the story of one family told in another play called Failure. There was an inquiry held, and a grand jury did indict the president and three other officers of the steamship's company for manslaughter, and the ship's captain and engineer for criminal carelessness. They found that the disaster was caused by conditions of instability, caused by any or all of overloading of passengers, mishandling of water ballast, or the original construction of the ship itself. A little bit about the history of the Eastland after. I guess I'll start in the beginning. We talked a little bit about it originally. Built in or ordered in 1902 by the Michigan Steamship Company. It was completed in 1903 and launched. That's when it was christened. Its maiden voyage was July 16th of 1903. It was nicknamed the Speed Queen of the Great Lakes. It was sold then in 1905 to the Michigan Transportation Company, given the name of the Eastland. They operated the Chicago and South Haven line. It was sold on August the 5th, 1906, to the Lakeshore Navigation Company of Cleveland, Ohio. Sold then in 1909 to the Eastland Navigation Company for the Cedar Point to Cleveland route. June 1st of 1914, it was sold to the St. Joseph Chicago Steamship Company of St. Joseph, Michigan, to be used again for that Cleveland and Cedar Point route. And then finally, it was sold in October of 1915 to a private individual, and then eventually was sold on November the 21st, 1917, to the Illinois Naval Reserve, and it was scrapped then after World War II for salvage, sold for scrap in 1946. It was used some during World War I and World War II for fleet transport, moving troops. And I would obviously hope, and I don't think there were any other disasters, that they were they paid particular attention to how many troops they put on board before they started taking them overseas on that particular ship. Because it was, even though it was built for the lake, it was seaworthy and could be used on the open oceans. So that is the story of the Eastland. Eventually, as I said, it was salvaged and sold, became part of the United States Navy's stock after going through some restorations and modification. It was also, at one point in her lifetime, belonging to the Navy, was designated a gunboat, and they renamed it the USS Wilmette, and then primarily they used her as a training vessel then on the Great Lakes. So that's what I have, Michael.
So she had a long life even after...
it did, even after the disaster. So
that's amazing.
Obviously, and I have not been able to find any information about how long it took them to right the ship again after it you know, listed and tipped over. But I would imagine that was quite a feat in itself, just being able to right that ship. I couldn't find anywhere... either in the book or in the research, the subsequent research that I did to find out what it actually weighed. I couldn't find any gross tonnage anywhere. But, you know, something that held 2,600 passengers plus cargo had to obviously weigh several tons. So given the equipment that they had in 1915 when that baby rolled over in the Chicago Harbor, I'm sure it was quite an exciting feat just to see the thing uprighted after the disaster. I do remember one of the stories in the book that fascinated me, and I don't remember the young man's name, but there was a young teenage boy. I don't think he was a passenger on the ship, if memory serves me right. It's been a few years since I read the book. But he saw the ship go over, and he dove into the water, and I forget how many people he saved himself.
Oh, really?
But he was given some sort of a medal for his gallantry and bravery that day for saving. And it was in the double-digit numbers of people that he pulled out of the water himself.
Okay, Fred, well, I'm going to cut you off there because we are down to just a few seconds.
Okay,
so
great.
Thanks,
well,
Fred
Malone.
And
I'll talk to you soon.
We'll have you back
great
soon.
Day.
Thank you.